On Thursday, January 25, 2014, Chad Harbach, author of The Art of Fielding, was interviewed by Jordan Taylor at Writer House in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Chad, it seems like around folks, people are like, the guy who made it big. Of the many people who have been through the MFA program, he's certainly one of the ones that my parents, who listen to NPR, know. And so I imagine you're all here tonight because you know him and his wonderful book that got wide acclaim from just about every print source out there in 2011. But I want to thank him for coming to have a chat. And I guess my kind of first question is, in this nice kind of confines here of a writer house, which is a really special place in a small town like this, which is to say, what are the pleasures of living and working? I guess your MFA time was here in Charlottesville.
Yeah.
And you continue to reside here. What are the small pleasures of a small town? Or are they big pleasures of a small town?
Oh, man, you're really putting me on the spot to start up.
It's a hometown crowd. You got to dip your toe in the water and appease them right up front. So say nice things.
Well, it's just so wonderful. Everything about it is so wonderful. I went to the MFA program here from 2001 to 2004, and then I moved to New York and kept working on my novel, which I had been working on when I was here and before I was here. Moved back to Charlottesville. I mean, I loved New York and lived there for 6 years and still run my magazine, N+1, out of Brooklyn. I came back about 2.5 years ago, and it's just addictively easy to live here and to just sort of have so much time to work because the necessities of life seem to just take care of themselves, as if little birds were doing them around you.
So nice. Somebody's described the velvet rut of Charlottesville really, really nicely. I guess I also wanted to ask, because I know your book that's coming out is about the kind of difference, the kind of two of what you see as the two literary cultures of America, kind of developing around the MFA program and around the kind of metropolitan centers of New York. My question is, how much was cost a factor in moving back to Charlottesville in terms of becoming a professional writer? Is it harder to be a professional writer in New York in terms of the kind of actually paying your rent and things like that? How much do you lose by kind of unplugging from the New York literary scene by living here?
Yeah, well, it's a big question. I mean, I wrote a piece for N+1 called MFA versus NYC before my book came out, about 3 years ago. Which we decided to turn into a book. And so, I mean, the book is a compilation of essays that I solicited from people and put together about, my basic premise in writing the essay was that, in the past 30 years, MFA programs have boomed. There were 30 of them in the early 80s, and now there are 500 of them. And so it's become this huge industry, and also this place where writers make money, right? So the kind of premise of the essay was that probably, fiction writers make just as much money by teaching and going to school and existing within the university system as they do through New York publishing. For the individual writer trying to make it, I mean, there are benefits to being in New York. There are benefits to just kind of meeting people who work in the industry and putting your name and your face in front of them from time to time, and also just kind of learning what the game is like in a way. I mean, you just even if you're not like a hustler, you kind of absorb certain things about what people are looking for by being around it. Which is good and bad, and mm-hmm. we could talk about that all night, but.
Yeah. I mean, I guess to just kind of follow up on that, the kind of bad conditions in that way, how much of it do you feel like writers in New York become market-driven rather than what they might want to follow from their individual voice or what they find of interest or the kind of novel they owe? I mean, do you think that writers in New York are overly conditioned by the market? Or is that a bad thing?
I mean, I think it's a potential danger. Mm-hmm. Of course, you can. There are a lot of writers in New York who are, holed up in their apartments and But you're influenced by the environment in which you live, in which you move, and you know there are dangers to living too deeply within the university environment, and there are dangers to never talking to anyone and never receiving any kind of outside stimuli. I do think the danger in New York is that if you're in New York and you're a writer who's trying to make it, you are, it's a kind of cozy industry, and you're going to the same events and probably the same parties as the editors and the agents, and so if you are too attuned to what you think they're looking for, you're not going to be. I mean, that's going to be wrong because they don't actually know what they're looking for. You have to hide out in your apartment and then tell them what they're looking for afterwards. It all comes down to the individual artist in the end. But I do think that's the danger there is to always have your ear to what might be marketable.
Yeah. And so what's the kind of counter danger in coming out of the MFA program? Is that you're too insular and too short story driven, too workshop driven?
Well, I think there's something that's happened in the past couple of decades as MFA culture has become economically viable, and it's become a place where writers kind of make careers as professors / writers. I think there's a corresponding danger there of becoming kind of careerist on that track, mm-hmm. right? And sort of gearing yourself to doing what you think is going to please the people who hold power in that universe. Mm-hmm. And that's not by writing a popular book, but it may be by writing a certain sort of book that's going to serve. I think there's this thing that happens now where, some people in MFA programs are ambitious within that culture and write a book that kind of serves as a dissertation, a kind of credential, that gets them on the teaching ladder, and so that's kind of, that has kind of similar pitfalls in a different way.
I mean, in the sense of like making a fetish of difficulty in terms of like how hard something is to read, or kind of a more modernist sense of it, or I guess maybe if I could personalize it to you, when you were writing Art of Fielding, which of these kind of twin poles did you feel like you were being more drawn towards? Did you feel like you had to write something that was saleable for an agent and for a publishing house, or did you feel like you wanted to write something that was a calling card for academia in terms of kind of a credentializing move? Does that make sense?
Well, definitely not the latter, because I was very dense about figuring out that world existed.
Yeah.
Looking back, I can see that like when I was in the MFA program here, I knew people in this MFA program and other MFA programs who were ambitious within the MFA world. I didn't actually know that existed.
Yeah.
I didn't have that idea that people, be like, oh, I should be vying for like a great professorial job as a teacher somewhere. It was only like, 6 years after I graduated that I figured out that part of it. Certainly I was trying, well, I mean, I certainly, I mean, if, so if anything, my ideas were oriented toward, whatever really vague ideas I had about the publishing world at that time. I wanted to write a book that people would buy and read, although certainly up until the very moment that the book came out, my novel about baseball and gay romance was not thought to be very marketable by people.
The culture caught up with you in a pretty nice way, right? I was wondering about kind of, and I promise only one baseball question the entire time.
Not baseball.
Oh, no. I just thought there would be lots of crowd participation moments for that. And I just like to say the word fungo a lot, so all I really have is like long arcing lob questions about baseball. I don't have any kind of, frozen ropes, as it were. So I did kind of wonder, is when you take up baseball as a subject, it is one of those kind of quintessential American literary genres. And were you ever visited by the ghost of George Will, George Plimpton, or three-fingered Mordecai Brown? Did you ever feel like the weight of that tradition while you were writing?
I mean, in a way, probably more the tradition of baseball than ever the tradition of the baseball novel, which actually I was fairly ignorant of. A lot of the great baseball novels I've read since my book came out, and some of them are really good, like The Natural, great book. I had never read it before. I was more, I mean, there's... I don't know. It was never. I mean, when I was a kid, certainly I was very into baseball, and I read a lot about baseball history, all along the way, and as I got a little bit older and started to read more literature, I mean, there were not many novels about sport that I felt really connected to, Don DeLillo's End Zone, a novel about college football, which is DeLillo's second novel and one of his least known, but it's really a tremendously funny, crisp, quick little book, which I adore and probably influenced my book a lot. And then David Foster Wallace writing about tennis, very very important to me in a lot of different ways, and really those were the novels about sport that I was kind of felt myself writing in the shadow of, and really not anything that was actually about baseball. I mean, of course you have DeLillo writing about baseball, also, but those, the kind of classic baseball novels, I really hadn't even read them.
It's nice to not be weighted by tradition, I have to say. And that was the other kind of major kind of genre, I mean, not genre, but kind of figure was Melville. And I felt like that was such a huge part of the book and so important to so many of your characters. Was that always going to be a centerpiece of the book, or was that something that just kind of evolved out of the process of writing it? Or was it always going to be Melville and baseball?
It happened... I mean, I don't know that it was part of my very first conception of whatever I thought I was doing in 2000 when I started the book, but certainly the Melville stuff started to crop up very early, and I mean, of course, I mean, on the one hand, it was just Moby Dick was my favorite novel, and I am so continually kind of entranced by that book. But also it as it started to crop up and kept cropping up, like it made sense, I think, because if I ever sort of considered what I was doing in a thematic way, I felt like I was kind of writing a book about male friendships and male relationships, like across a kind of wide spectrum, from like really close friendship and mentorship and to kind of antagonistic competitive relationships, to a romantic one, and I kind of in a way felt like that was what the book was about. And of course the best eminent American novel of male relationships is Moby Dick, by a long shot. So its presence in the book kind of felt natural to me, and I was kind of trying to find a way to keep it there and include that stuff without, and having it be a kind of lighthearted, kind of humorous allusion. I mean, you run a date, like if you write a book and you're constantly reminding people of the existence of a much better book the whole time they're reading it, like that's a very dangerous game to play, so I wanted all the harpooners and Melville stuff to be able to kind of hang there in the background, and hopefully kind of enhance what's going on, but not feel like it's kind of oppressing the whole novel.
Although Moby Dick has got to be oppressive and impressive in a lot of ways. And as a great American novel, I feel like it's almost ex-nominated. Like, nobody's going to hold it against you for you know.
Right, yeah, that's true.
It's like, I'm in the Melville tradition. Well, aren't we all?
Yeah. And also such a funny book, which people don't remember or give it credit for. And I was kind of trying to...
I always try to convince my students of that. And then I always pull the one scene when they have the kind of whale's foreskin on his head and he's kind of dancing around the boat. And I was like, no, this is a totally fun book. I just also remember it being a kind of big issue that we had a cohort who would have been at grad school the same time as us. It was quoted in the New York Times for suggesting that sexuality was essential part of Melville and Moby Dick, and they thought it was kind of laughable. But now I feel like 10 years later, it's of course it is, which is nice. Can I ask, I mean, is Melville something the kind of thing you did as an undergrad and as a grad student? Have you taught Melville, or did you know Melville for kind of the reader's pleasures, or have you actually kind of put yourself in the kind of the president of Westish's school of feet, at least in terms of having to teach the book and orient your life around it?
Yeah, I mean, maybe I've arranged my life around it, but I've never taught it. I've never really taught anything. But I taught, when I was a sophomore in college, I took a seminar on Melville. It was not a popular class. There were five of us who took it. Including a close friend of mine, and I spent a semester, you know, but that was where I read Moby Dick. I was 18, maybe 19, and that's where I read Moby Dick for the first time, and I spent a few months like immersed in Melville, and it was probably really formative for me in some way.
Made it into your books.
And, yeah.
All the way through. Is that the I don't want to get too deep down the hole of this book, but I do kind of want to think back about kind of like the classroom setting and the MFA setting, because was the Art of Fielding a book that you did a lot of kind of the traditional MFA workshopping with? What were the reactions like in graduate school, or as people kind of came to see drafts, and was that a scarring experience, a good experience?
I started the book. I had the idea for the book, and I started working on it in 2000, mm-hmm. And so the first kind of chapters that I wrote were my application to MFA programs, because I had been at that time I had been out of college for like 4 years, and I was just kind of working crappy jobs, and then I would go home and try to write. And then I'd go back to my crappy job, and then I'd go home and try to write, and I'd be like, this sucks, my friends are at a party, and I'm just kind of going, flopping back and forth between these two things, neither of which are going all that well. So for the first few years, I wrote a lot of stories, and they were bad. I wrote one good story that kept me going for a couple of years, just psychologically. And then I decided I got to get out of this kind of treadmill that I'm on, so I'm gonna do this thing that I thought I might not do, which is apply to an MFA program or a bunch of MFA programs. Mm-hmm. And so the first things that I'd written for the book became my application. Mm-hmm. So I showed up here thinking that that was what I was going to be working on, and it was what I was going to be what I worked on for a while. But I got really frustrated. I mean, it was mostly my fault, but I got really frustrated with the kind of process of trying to turn in parts of a novel to a workshop. I think that in a processual kind of way, there are reasons why historically the workshop has always been geared around the short story. There are sound, structural, pedagogical reasons, you know, for that. Probably braver souls than I can probably make a novel work in that situation. But for me, what would happen would be that I would have a due date, and I would work to like kind of craft something that could be turned in for the due date. And then I would turn in, and I'd be like, you know, and like, now I'm just going to sit here for a week until we actually workshop this little, this, 20 pages that I turned in. Yeah. So then I, so then I'm at a standstill for a week, and then I would go to the workshop, and people liked what I was doing, but they would just say, the workshop, they would just say, okay, keep, so I don't know why I would be worried about it in advance, or why I would, be like, oh my God, I don't know what they're going to say. Cause then they would say, well, it seems perfectly fine, but it's only, it's a tiny part of this book. It's like showing us a man's finger and asking us to judge how handsome he is. And so, I wound up putting it aside and writing other stuff for most of my time here. And then I went back to it right at the very end and wrote a bunch of stuff for my thesis. But for like a year, the main year and a half that I was taking workshops, I decided to do other things because I think, writing a novel involves, it's this slow process of accretion, mm-hmm. And you have to kind of you're kind of evaluating it every nanosecond, but at the same time, you have to set aside certain of your, faculties of evaluation. You just have to say, the first thing that I'm going to do is I'm going to, make this stack, a big stack of paper, and every day I'm going to add three pieces of paper to the stack. And, so it's like, it's a really, it's a kind of fundamental process. And I don't think the for me at least, the rhythms of the workshop are not more conducive to it.
Gotcha. So were the rhythms of, you talked about kind of as a founder of N+1, is that a relationship you ever kind of relinquished in your time in grad school, or were you always, that was always part of your kind of writing life was editor and as founder?
I finished here in 2004, and that was the year that the first issue of, the first issue of N+1 came out like 2 months after I graduated. So they were pretty much separate.
Separate ones, mm-hmm. at all. So as you kind of travel in the world around N+1, did that have any effect on kind of you getting back to writing novels, or did you show that to people you worked with, or was the, when you returned to the novel, was that a more of a solitary pursuit?
It was pretty solitary. I think that we started N+1 in 2004, and that's when I was trying to work on the novel in earnest. I think N+1 was both. It caused me to grow a lot intellectually, which I think, over time was very good for the novel. On a day-to-day basis, of course, it was very bad for the novel because once I moved to New York that year, I had a job. And then I had a second full-time unpaid job working for N+1. And then I was also trying to write the book. So just on a kind of administrative level, N+1 was horrible for the novel. Because the novel became this kind of third thing that I was trying to squeeze in all the time. But of course, over a period of time, being able to just kind of work with my co-editors at N+1 and be able to kind of learn from them, I think just, changed what I'm able to do as a writer, I think.
And so that came from kind of seeing other submissions, or was it from working with editors, the kind of intellectual growth you're talking about? Was it kind of interpersonal stuff, or was it seeing what other people were sending to you and saying, I don't want to be that?
I guess I mostly just mean all my co-editors then and now, they're all just a lot smarter than me. And so it's just a boon to be able to get emails from them and listen to what they have to say about virtually anything, and it just kind of enriches your sensibility.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I've noticed that kind of many of the people who are involved with N+1 from the they all have book contracts, it seems like, or all seemingly do things. Do you feel a need to kind of do some literary back scratching of your cohorts, or is it or they're books you already like and it's easy to kind of
back scratching? Word
for Melville, right?
Well, no, it didn't work for him at all.
Not at all, come to think of it.
that guy had a really tough time. A lot of the reason why we started the magazine was that, in the beginning there were five of us, and then that group expanded very quickly. But I just thought that those other four writers were just, I was like, I looked at them and, you know, we were all, you know, 27, 28 and none of us had really published anything. But I looked at those four people and I was like, I don't know what's going to happen to me, but I'm looking at four really, really like top notch writers. And there were other kind of reasons for the project and genesis of the project, but I mean, I know that I from the start just believed in those guys so much as writers, and you know, and the same with some of the people we picked up along the way. So, I mean, the fact that I, you know, 7 years later got put in kind of a position that I might be able to scratch their backs at some point, to me, it's like really gratifying.
Really nice to be kind of have the company. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
They were coited in it. That was the, in terms of kind of your kind of editing duties with M+1, or what is your, I don't know, day in, day out seems really hackney, but what's your kind of day-to-day relationship with M+1?
Yeah, I mean, it's less. I mean, I do stuff for the magazine every single day, but it's not the way for the first 5 years that we were in existence. I mean, we were a very small little startup organization. We, you know, the first issue cost us $8,000 to make and print, which was money that was just our money that we pooled together. And then we printed 2,000 copies of the first magazine and we sold them. And then we were like, all right, now we have to do it again. which is to say that, the magazine very quickly became a kind of full-time enterprise for quite a few people, but none of us ever got paid for that. So in the first like 5 or 6 years of N+1, I'd work on the magazine like 40, 50 hours a week at least, more if we were in production. Now we've actually gotten to the point where we have it's too small, but we've had a staff. We have almost four full-time employees. Because what happens, like you start, you're like, we're going to start this amazing artistic enterprise. And then 9 months later, you're sitting there reading like Accounting for Dummies and carrying beer up the stairs and all this. And you're like, how did I get here? So you just spend years and years doing these bureaucratic jobs. But now we actually get to pay people a reasonable salary to do some of the more onerous things, for one thing. I edit pieces. I'm on the board. The book that we mentioned earlier, the MFA versus NYC, is the first project in a partnership between N+1 and FSG. And so we're co-publishing that book. Over the past 2 years, one of the main things that I've been doing for N+1 is editing that book.
Mm-hmm. And so you said you solicited other writers for that collection about the kind of different literary cultures of the MFA programs and
yeah, yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. So who were there people you were that immediately sprang to mind that I would love to hear what they had to say about the kind of current state of kind of, you know, not literary mentorship, but also essentially how one becomes a writer.
Yeah.
Was there one that got away? Let's start there.
The one who got away.
Thomas Pynchon.
Actually, the one who got away is a crazy person, an admirable crazy person, a writer named Tao Lin. who N+1 has had many insane dealings with over the years, but and Tao published a very good strange novel called Taipei last summer. But Tao he's like the first and only writer to ever really like make money via internet culture. He was at NYU like several years ago, and he was just like, he would just do these crazy stuff. He's like, I'm writing this book. I'm selling shares of it. Who wants a share of my book for $200? Because I need to buy some ramen. And then he sold like 20 shares of that book. And then he sold, Melville House sold some copies and he paid the people back. One time my co-editor Keith and I, we caught him down in the subway. He was, cause they were, he would put these, he would go down in the subway and he would put Tao Lin stickers up all over the place. And we would see these, and then one day we caught him. We were like, Tao, we got you, man. He was like, oh crap.
Do you want to pass these out for me?
So Tao is a very interesting figure, because of course there's a lot of talk about, internet writing is of course a very interesting phenomenon that's been happening and evolving for a lot of years. And Tao actually made some money out of it and then published a novel with a major publisher, which went really well for him. And so I asked him to write a piece, and he about the money that he has made in the past 10 years and like where it came from. And he sent me the first half of this piece, and it was amazing. It was fascinating. And I was like, Tao, great. But then Tao had a kind of breakdown, and he refused to finish the piece. And then he spent like a couple days on Facebook agonizing over whether he should return to the piece, and I could see all this happening. That's the one that got away.
Wow. That's good. It's really a natural segue to my next question, which was, everybody's heard about your advance. Where did all your money go? But it definitely was a thing. I remember in the coverage was your advance and how much you got. It seems to me, by its very face, it has to be incredibly bizarre to have to interact with your friends when they know what your advance is. Or was it ever an issue with your friends, or does everyone kind of politely look the other way and have a watercress sandwich?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it was cool with my friends knew, my actual friends. my friends knew what I had been going through for the previous 5 to 35 years, and they knew how poor I was and how long I had been that poor, and so I think mostly they didn't begrudge it to me too much. It's a funny thing. I mean, it's a lot of money, but it's like what happened to me was that, 2 days after the novel was sold, there was a week or whatever it was, there was a big piece about me in Bloomberg News, in which the number, a slightly inaccurate number of my advance was in the headline of the piece on Bloomberg News. And so my advance was, I'm not like a dentist or anything.
Yeah. You don't have regular customers.
No. I'm not like rich like a dentist or a lawyer or something. But like the
Dennis rich.
Not dentist rich. But it's funny to have your salary published in.
Yeah, no, that's kind of what I was wondering. I also wonder how much of that is part of the kind of a marketing of a young writer now. Is how much the advance is, and if that's just comes with the territory.
Right. I don't think it's a bad, it's not a bad move to have people know that. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's personally can be like a heavy thing to have people know. But from a public relations standpoint, it's probably want to publicize that.
And I'm sure there's a starry-eyed 10-year-old out there who says, I can make it as a writer.
If the 10-year-old is reading Bloomberg News,
they're probably growing up really fast.
They don't need to become a writer.
Yeah, exactly. They all have very involved screen lives. You never know. All the way through. There was some other pieces, and this is just for a random kind of like to cleanse our palate sorbet weird question I just wanted to ask, which is, if you were imagining kind of your book where you would like it to be placed on a shelf with adjacent books on either side, what would you really hope for? I mean, if nobody was going to see it, it could be your own personal, except for these people here, which will all swear to silence. But if you could ideally have this book placed between two other books, what would you like your shelf company to be?
Oh, well, I mean, I think I already said the answer, which is Infinite Jest and End Zone. If Infinite Jest was for me, that book came out in 1996, and I graduated from college in 1997 and read that book as I was graduating, And, you know, as I was at this moment, I mean, I guess I was always at this moment, but when you graduate from college, the moment really declares itself of just having no idea what to do with myself. You know, I just didn't know. A lot of my friends were very, you know, were oriented towards some particular thing. I had no idea what I was going to do. I went home and lived in my parents' basement for a long time, and you know, I don't know, yeah, just earned minimum wage. But also I'd been in college, I'd been studying literature, but I had not, you know, and had been immersed in it, in American literature particularly, but, you know, it was pre-internet days for one thing. And, I had no conception, you know, I was kind of living within this world of books that, you know, seemed to terminate around like 1950, you know? And so there's this, on the one hand, you have this kind of idea that you want your life to be kind of made in literature, but then you also have this idea of literature as being a historical phenomenon. You know, and when I was in college, like, you know, my idea of a contemporary book was like Lolita, right? And so reading Infinite Jest at the moment that I was graduating was really gripping for me, because it was like kind of clearly a continuation of that tradition that I was familiar with, you know, but also it was like very clearly like of the moment and like kind of speaking to me in that moment. So it was a kind of transitional object for me, I guess, to like, you know, make me feel like someone could write a novel in the present.
Yeah. No, I was unemployed in New York City, having the exact same experience at the same time.
Yeah.
And I went to grad school for English for some reason. So that's which is great to hear in some ways. And I remember also in the piece you originally wrote for N Plus One, and that was reprinted in Slate, about kind of NYC versus MFA. You date Wallace's death as like a kind of specific moment, it seems like, of kind of change within the MFA programs. Is that a claim you would have made 3 years ago that doesn't feel quite as relevant now? Or is it, I mean, it seems for a lot of writers in their 20s and 30s that Wallace's death is some sort of moment that you didn't have to contend with him anymore.
Oh, that's not what I mean. That's not what I meant.
I know. No, I've completely twisted your words into a perverse
and I don't even remember what I meant.
To make you uncomfortable, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
I'll stall for time you to think. In the article, you mentioned something about the kind of Westward, the Course of Empire, as like a quintessential workshop story in some ways that really kind of talks about that. And then you're saying kind of after his death, there seemed to be kind of a moment where this maybe wasn't going to be the... Where things didn't seem to kind of like hold the same narrative anymore. I might just be completely misremembering the piece here, and just putting you on the spot to talk about Foster Wallace.
I don't remember what I said, to be honest with you. One very interesting thing about Wallace, for one thing, is that he's really a creature of the institution.
Yeah.
You know, and he, he never, you know, his, he's a kind of, and I'm in a way, I'm kind of stealing this idea from a critic named Mark McGurl, who wrote something about this recently. But you know, Wallace, he proceeded basically immediately from being an undergrad at Amherst to being in an MFA program at the University of Arizona, with a stop at Harvard to try to do a philosophy PhD, which not try because he could have done it, but he left it. And then, you know, and very quickly got back to teaching in Illinois and then in California, and spent most of his life, you know, within the frame of the university. And also, as we know, like, you know, within the frame of Alcoholics Anonymous and a lot of other kind of, and I knew him a little, and went to church regularly, and was a real kind of creature, inhabitor of institutions. you know, which makes him a very interesting writer vis-a-vis questions about MFA programs, because he both, you know, because he both kind of disdained these strictures, but also kind of spent his entire life living inside of them.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I still regularly copy sections from his syllabus that circulates out there about kind of late work and late work policy. I mean, he has amazing syllabi if you've never seen it. I guess I can transition to a kind of question I had about kind of institutions in general, but in particular about the small liberal arts college, which is the kind of setting and centerpiece of the book in a lot of ways, which is what kind of research, how did you come to know those kind of, I felt like you kind of captured the kind of like wonderful, comforting, you know, insular feel of a liberal arts college in a lot of ways. What kind of research you did, and was there any specific model you had, or was it just kind of favorite amalgams with some Melville thing?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really for the book, like as a whole, I had a kind of no research rule. You know, I think that was kind of the basic precept that I was, or a constraint that I was working within. I was like, this book will be about things that I, not that I know, but that I can, that I feel like I can reliably make up. And I mean, I went to Harvard. I'm from Wisconsin, you know, which of course is where the book is set. And you know, my sister and like a lot of people who I know went to these small liberal arts schools in Wisconsin, you know, so I've been to them and I've been around them. You know, so I think really the, you know, Westish College is just it's just a kind of amalgam of my own college experience and my Wisconsin experience. And, you know, I just kind of put those things together. And, you know, if you've been to, you know, my school was slightly bigger, but it's not that hard to imagine what a slightly smaller, you know, school would be like. So it's really, it's kind of my own college experience kind of transported to the place where I grew up.
Yeah. Have you had anyone who's read the book say, you know, you were describing my school, or you were describing, you know, or someone who was kind of really trying to kind of fiercely lay claim to your fictional world?
In Wisconsin, this is a big thing. This is like it's like a parlor game kind of. Yeah, everyone's like...
It's
like
Beloit, right?
It's like Beloit. Yeah. It's Ripon. It's Lawrence. It's Carthage. It's St. Norbert. It's fun for me when people get enthused about it. But the president of Ripon called me up. He was like, it's Ripon.
I wanted to offer you a job as an assistant football, baseball coach, whatever you wanted.
Yeah. So there are people in Wisconsin, people lay claim, which, you know, which of course is very nice. It makes it feel like they felt like they thought it was real.
So I'm trying to think of, so there was never a question about Wisconsin. It was always going to be what you knew best, where you grew up.
I think there was a little bit of uncertainty at the start where I thought I might set it in New England.
That was what I was wondering.
You know, because that's where I went to college, and because the Melville stuff did come up very early. You know, so I think there was, you know, was this college going to be, at the very outset, this was going to be the ocean, mm-hmm. the actual ocean,
yeah.
and not the kind of Phocean of... I just made that up. I never said that before. Of Lake Michigan. but for many reasons that I eventually settled on the kind of doing it on the shore of Lake Michigan.
Yeah. Is the kind of one question, because it's about liberal arts and sports, and athletes at liberal arts colleges take up a far greater percentage of the student body than they do at a kind of juggernaut place like a Texas or Michigan or something like that. And it's always kind of struck me as odd in terms of athletics. You know the athletes a lot more on a small liberal arts campus. They play kind of a different place, but there's also a sense of there's not a kind of scholarship program. A lot of them are paying their way like Schwartz does, or paying part of their way. I mean, was that something that you found of interest as you were writing the book, that the kind of like tension between sports and the liberal arts, or was that always kind of a kind of structuring tension you saw in the book, or was it something you never cared about at all? And I'm just bringing it up.
Yeah, I mean, in a way it was just something I was very much struck by as an undergraduate.
Yeah.
you know, I played a lot of sports in high school. And I mean, it's because it's true. I mean, yeah, because Harvard undergraduate, it's not such a big place. And there are a lot of athletes. And I didn't play a sport there, but I largely kind of, a lot of my friends were athletes. And I had never met people like this before. You know, people like Mike Schwartz, kind of, who were, you know, kind of really physically gifted and really, really intellectually serious. And I was amazed by these guys. You know, and a couple of them were my really close friends, and I had never encountered anyone like that before. You know, so in a way, like that, in a way, that combination was just something I was fascinated by. You know, and of course, it's nice, and also setting the book. You know, of course, the book was going to be about baseball, and so setting it at this little liberal arts college, you know, allowed me to set it in a fairly idyllic sporting world where there's not a lot of money around, and so people are playing the game because they want to play the game. You know, so I didn't have to have a big like steroid scandal or something like that like intervene in the book.
Oh, it's always like an insult in the book whenever anybody mentions steroids. It's always like, those guys are on steroids.
Right.
They have to be well financed, right? All the way through. So when you're thinking about characters and kind of generating characters, was Schwartz one of the first characters that kind of comes to mind, or was it always Henry as the centerpiece, or kind of in what order did the characters kind of, did they come about?
Yeah, I mean, I think they came in, you know, there's five main characters, and I think they came very quickly, but in kind of two groups, because, I mean, Mike and Henry kind of came together at the outset. You know, and in a way, I sort of conceived of the book at the start as a kind of romance between those two guys, and that's sort of what it continues to be. And then the other three characters, you know, Pella and her dad and Owen, they also kind of cropped up together, and they did so kind of. It was kind of the fortuitous moment, I guess, in the early part of working on the book, where I had these two guys, Mike and Henry, and I was writing what was one of the first things I wrote, which was going to be the scene where Henry's roommate is going to get hit in the face by the ball, you know, which now is maybe on page 85 or whatever of the book, but like was actually one of the very first things that I wrote in a different version, obviously. So I was setting out to write this scene in which I knew this thing that was going to happen, but I wanted the scene to be narrated by neither one of those guys, because, you know, if you're an athlete, you're playing in a game, your thoughts are not very interesting. You know, it's like, should I call a curveball or should I call a...
It's the classic Wallace line about why do we expect anyone to say anything interesting at the end of a sports interview.
Right.
We're going to hang together as a team. We're going to win as a team. Just saying that you know, there's nothing less exciting than interviewing an athlete about what he's just done.
Yeah, your mind should be clear. So I was looking for this a kind of disinterested observer to watch this thing happen. And so I started writing the scene, and I started writing this person who's watching it, and it turned out that this person was the president of the college. Yeah. And I was like, all right, that's interesting. You may continue.
Yeah.
And you know, and then I was like, well, so why is he there? And it turned out that he was there because he had this kind of infatuation with one of the players on the team. And I was like, that is also interesting. That was the one thing in the book, and it's a big thing, but it's the one thing in the book that kind of emerged in the writing of it. And then all of a sudden, that really just writing that scene. I mean, of course, I'm saying this in 30 seconds. This probably took a year in my life, but just from writing that scene, I had those other three central characters, who I kind of knew I wanted, because I knew from the outset that I didn't want to write a baseball book. And so I knew that I wanted and needed these central characters like the Athenites who don't care about baseball.
Yeah. And so, and so the, those characters when they come, and I guess I'm trying to think of the best way to say it, but those kind of what you think of as kind of as secondary or kind of reflecting characters in some ways that came up through the process, I was always kind of struck about one of the hardest things that when I talk to friends about writing is always kind of the issue of not sexuality as like a being, but like sexual as in the practice and how much you want to show and what part of that you reveal and what part remains behind closed doors. And was that a problem in terms of kind of like depicting kind of both sexuality and sexual practice within the book, or was it the kind of thing that you look forward to doing, or was it the kind of thing? How did you set that kind of level of comfort for both yourself and your reader, or would you like to both be uncomfortable? Speaking of uncomfortable, this is our time.
Yeah, well, I mean, I didn't actually depict any of it.
Yeah, that's what I'm
saying. So I chose the Tolstoyan route, I guess. I mean, in a way, that was, you know, and I can always tell, when, I mean, there are a lot of people on the internet who are like, there's so much disgusting sex in this book, and those are angry homophobes, those people, of whom there are many who react, because the book, I mean, you know, because the book was lucky enough to get a kind of wide reception, and so that means that a lot of people picked it up who didn't quite know what they were picking up, and that led to a lot of interesting responses, but... Yeah, I mean, it is. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe I, in a way, just sort of, maybe like sex is hard to write, and so I just chickened out. would be one way to put it. But another way to do it is that another way to put it is that you can do a lot with a very little.
That's what I say. Just think about. There's so much refrain about potential in the book, right? Mm-hmm. Lots of potential. Lots of potential. I guess now it's time for as many baseball questions as we can stack in.
Question.
Yeah, there's one.
I had a question. You talked a little about the different influences in how you sort of set up the school, and when I was reading it the first time, I had this eerie sense of, you know, this sounds very familiar, and I think it was the fact that Melville quotes were in brochures and in the locker rooms, and that there were statues of Melville. And then I read that you were actually at UVA. Do you think that the whole, like, Mr. Jefferson everywhere played some role in how you saw Melville's role at the university?
I mean, I'm sure, yeah, I think that's true. But then also, I mean, for me, I think being... going to college when I was 17, and having never been away from home, and then going to this place that was, you know, 1,200 miles away, was like such a profound shock to me. that I think that was a lot of the experience that I was reacting to in the book. So in a way, I think it is like much more about my undergraduate experience than it was about being here. But I see what you're saying.
So I had this professor of mine, George Saunders, who gave us this little chat about the dangers of the NYC culture.
And he's in the book. He's in my book, by the way.
And he talked about how we can compare what he said to me to what he says in the book. He said that you can get all these connections in New York. You can chat up an editor who's like, yeah, send me your book. Yeah, you know, whatever. And you can maybe get a book published that way. But nobody knows 10,000 people through connections. That there needs to be something in your book that will appeal to a massive amount of people if you want it to be successful enough to get, you know, beyond the second book and the third book. And so he in that way he seemed to somewhat belittle the NYC thing. But what I was wondering was what you thought about that. And then I was also wondering if. Is it that you're rubbing shoulders with editors and agents and stuff that something of the more commercial market rubs off, and it's not just like what's hot this year, but also formulating maybe more, you know, stronger plot lines or something that like maybe genre authors are more into than say literary people?
Yeah, I mean it's a whole set of such messy questions. I mean, look, when I sent my book to agents, I had been living in New York for 5 years and running this magazine, And so in a way, I knew some people. And there were two agents who represented friends of mine, both great top agents, who knew that I was writing this book and knew my work in N plus One and were actively asking me if they could read my book. And so in a way, you would say this is the great benefit of being in New York is to have, these agents are asking for my book, which is true. That's really true. But then both of those agents turned me down, as did six other agents before I hooked on with my agent. I got there were eight agents who shot me down before I hooked up with Chris. Which is to say, like, you can meet all the people you want, but they are gonna, they didn't want to represent my book, I mean, of course, what he says about 10,000 people is entirely true. Nobody has any idea what's going to succeed, especially in terms of literary type fiction. It's such an alchemical thing. I mean, there's this it's a technical book, but there's a very, very good book about the film industry by this economist named Art Devaney. And he writes this book about kurtotic economics and Hollywood, and it's a brilliant book, which basically just kind of mathematically demonstrates the principle that no one knows anything, and that no one, with regard to movies, like you market the hell out of a movie, you sell the hell out of a movie, no one ever has any idea what's going to happen. All you can do is put it in theaters and hope that the audience likes it.
It's luck and timing.
Yeah, so to me, it's about, for the publishing industry, it's about giving as many books as possible a kind of chance to actually get in front of the public, and see if the public is going to react to them. And the publishing industry is doing a good job if they are actually like getting the maximum number of books a real chance. For the writer. Yeah, I mean Brooklyn is New York is a great place because there's a great community of writers, and also virtually all of the people who work in publishing are really like serious, enthusiastic, engaged, intelligent people, it's good just to be, in a sense it's very good to just be around them. And to kind of absorb their enthusiasm and knowledge about books. You can go too far because you can try to please them, and of course you shouldn't actually be trying to please anybody.
Thank you very much.